bottom line is that the policy that's in place is not delivering the future that Alaska needs to be able to support the needs of its populations.
The oil companies make their pitch for lower taxes. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, March 21st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an independent auditor raises questions about the Goose Creek prison.
I, frankly, am at a loss as to whether or not investors were told the truth about how much this project was going to cost.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
A Democratic congressman from Massachusetts is rallying against the idea to build a natural gas pipeline from the North Slope to Tidewater in Alaska for export to Asia. This fall, Governor Sean Parnell came out in favor of the idea, saying prospects to build a pipeline to Canada in the lower 48 weren't favorable. But Representative Ed Markey calls it a scheme and says if Alaska exports gas to the Chinese, quote, Uncle Sam really would deserve to be called Uncle Sucker. Larry Pursley is federal coordinator for the Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline. He says Representative Markey has been an outspoken opponent of exporting liquefied natural gas out of the United States, but he says he's several steps ahead of reality.
It's a great thing about energy policy debate in this country is that the rhetoric gets way ahead of the facts. Exxon, ConocoPhillips, BP are not planning to build an export pipeline to send North Slope gas to China, despite Representative Markey's statement. Everyone's waiting to see if the three producers will go along with the governor's request to work together to study whether a project makes sense.
Representative Markey was not available for an interview, but in a press release, he says exporting U.S. gas will raise prices for U.S. consumers. Pursley says that's not true.
Right now, they're disconnected markets. You could export natural gas from Alaska, and it's not going to affect the lower 48 because there's no way to get it there anyhow.
Currently, there are 8 applications before the Department of Energy to export U.S. natural gas, but Representative Markey has introduced a bill in Congress that requires any natural gas extracted from taxpayer-owned federal land to be resold to American consumers. Pursley does not expect that legislation to pass. In a statement, Senator Mark Begich called Markey's comments laughable, saying, yet again, Representative Markey is trying to shut down any Alaska development. The state's major oil companies today continue to promote their requirement that they must see meaningful tax cuts before the state sees meaningful production increases. ConocoPhillips Alaska Vice President of Finance Robert Heinrich told the Senate Finance Committee that the bill before them, SB 192, would not lead to any change in the production decline.
Not to say the numbers don't seem big on a dollar basis. Our industry works in big numbers. ConocoPhillips alone has invested over $25 billion in Alaska since 2000. The reduction's almost $300 million to producers, but that's in the context of the taxes paid of nearly $15 billion. It's immaterial. That's less than a 2% reduction.
His estimates were calculated with oil priced at $130 per barrel. Heinrich also complained about the proposed cap on the progressivity element, that part of the tax that increases the rate as prices increase. He said that has the biggest impact on long-term cash flow and cash generation.
Between $100 and $130, the producer share doesn't move much. That's the part of what makes Alaska investment less competitive or less attractive as prices increase. Another component of this is a cap on the production tax rate at 60%. It doesn't help much in the price environments we've seen. It takes prices at greater than $230 before the cap would kick in, and we don't expect to be in that price environment for quite some time.
Heinrich also strongly encouraged the committee to include the older, already producing wells in any tax incentives. He said those wells are the base of the company's income and would give the quickest return on increased production. Committee co-chair Bert Stedman said a cap on progressivity is one of the topics the committee will discuss, basing his presentation on a description of the current tax regime as broken. BP's Alaska head of finance, Damian Bilbao, presented a worst-case scenario based on projections made by the Parnell administration. He said the state faces a crisis that must be dealt with quickly.
In fact, if you consider that in 2012, the break-even price for the state remains over $90 a barrel, I think the bottom line is that the policy that's in place is not delivering the future that Alaska needs to be able to support its infrastructure, the needs of its populations, as well as all the additional requirements that I know you guys spent a lot of time discussing. And
Stedman assured Bilbao that the legislature does review the administration's projections as well as those produced by the legislature itself.
But we don't accept them blindly as that's what's going to happen in the future. Because no one in their right mind would run the state straight into the ground.
Bilbao said BP will take a look at the final committee bill before considering whether it meets the company's needs. Exxon's production manager Dale Pittman said his company will support decisions on investments made by the operators of the field in which it works, ConocoPhillips and BP. The committee will continue its work on the new tax plan tomorrow morning. An audit on Matanuska Susitna Borough's Goose Creek Correctional Center finds facility construction cost overruns were avoidable. The Anchorage Certified Public Accountant who conducted the audit says the report raises questions, but state and borough officials contend the accountant did not understand the intent of the legislature. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports.
The Goose Creek Correctional Facility is set to open soon, although lingering doubts about the costs of its construction and operations have seemingly not been put to rest. Last year, the Senate Finance Committee asked for an audit on prison costs based on concerns about cost overruns. Now Anchorage accountant John Johns says prison costs were exceeded by $50 million over restrictions set by the 2004 legislation authorizing construction of a new state prison.
Governmental accounting standards require me to communicate to the client if I observe during the course of my audit indications of fraud and illegal activity. Regrettably, I have observed both.
Johns's audit found the prison should have cost no more than $252 million. In a letter to finance co-chair Bert Stedman included in the audit, Johns says the state was not cooperative in supplying him with receipts, emails, and documentation of agreements with the Matanuska Susitna Borough regarding the prison. Johns says he's calling for an investigation into the prison budget.
There were two versions of the budget, one for public consumption, one for internal project management purposes.
Department of Corrections officials deny a secret budget, but say there were two budgets, construction and operations, based on the cost per prison bed, and that the project stayed within bed costs. DOC Director of Administrative Services Leslie Houston says the DOC stands by the calculations provided to the Senate Finance Committee in 2011.
We do not believe there are cost overruns, and what the auditor did was they lumped together several different projects and included them, you know, basically viewed them as all one. One item for sure is the wastewater treatment facility, which we do not view as a state project, and we did not claim those funds against the overall capital cost.
And Houston says the state cooperated fully with the audit. The Matanuska Susitna Borough paid for construction of the prison and sold bonds in December of 2008 to finance the project. Borough Purchasing Officer Russ Kraft says Johns's focus on the cost restrictions of the law, SB 65, are misleading.
He's taking the generally accepted accounting principles and applying them to a project trying to interpret legislative intent. The financing that was used by the borough in conjunction with the state actually was set by the parameters in SB 65.
Kraft says SB 65 established construction costs and the borough stayed within the lines. He says Johns's comparison of restrictions of SB 65 and actual prison costs is not accurate. Kraft agrees with Houston that the budget appears to be out of balance because Johns lumped costs of a sewer and water project in with total construction costs. Another audit sticking point seems to be the bonds sold to finance prison construction. John Johns.
I, frankly, am at a loss as to whether or not investors were told the truth about how much this project was going to cost when those bonds were sold.
The borough sold the bonds, but the state had to stand behind the credit backing them up, according to Kraft. Under the agreement between the state and the borough, the state will lease the prison facility for 25 years, and the state is already making lease payments on the prison. Those payments are paid directly to the creditors. Again, Leslie Houston.
And we did not include the interest on the bonds as part of the capital construction costs either, because we started paying the lease in March of 2009 before construction was complete, that was not viewed as capital interest to the state.
Johns says he has additional information backing up his claims and that he is about ready to hand it over to his client, Senator Bert Stedman, who along with Senator Johnny Ellis called for the prison audit a year ago. Senator Ellis said through an aide on Monday that he had no specific comment on the audit. Senator Bert Stedman's office did not return phone calls for comment. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, forget North Carolina and Michigan State. In Alaska, the action is in Juneau at the gold medal tournament.
It's been a big part of my family's life for as long as I can remember.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2012 PFD. Also, paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This Friday marks the two-year anniversary of the Affordable Care Act, President Obama's health care overhaul. Its birthday present will be a trip to the Supreme Court next week. Justices will hear arguments on whether two aspects of the law are constitutional, the individual mandate requiring citizens to purchase health insurance and the Medicaid expansion. Alaska is one of 26 states suing to overturn the law, but the state has also benefited from the Affordable Care Act. John Hammerland is regional administrator for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. He points to several health care changes that have happened in Alaska because of the law.
There are many more preventive benefits that are now offered under Medicare that are available to Alaskan beneficiaries, and they are paying much less out of pocket. And in many cases, these preventive benefits, these important screenings, are completely free to the Medicare beneficiaries. So, for example, they now have the opportunity to get an annual wellness exam with their physician. There's also benefits to other Alaskans, those who had pre-existing conditions and couldn't in the past get insurance coverage or couldn't afford insurance coverage because the insurance companies were charging an arm and a leg because of their pre-existing conditions. They now have the opportunity to acquire affordable insurance coverage. Alaskans who are 26 or younger are able to continue to get health insurance coverage under their parents' plans or family plans. So those are just some of the benefits that the Affordable Care Act has brought already.
Like many states, Alaska has made little progress on the insurance exchange that is supposed to be up and running in 2014 and offer an easy way to find affordable insurance. How troubling or problematic is the slow progress on this front?
Each state is sort of fashioning their own solution, and they're in various stages of progress and readiness towards this. We are doing all that we can to offer technical assistance to states and through our regulatory process offering as much flexibility as we can to allow the states to fashion solutions that work for them. And so we're really just waiting to see how this will play out. And of course, if a state cannot put together an exchange or a marketplace in time, then the law calls for a fallback where the federal government will offer a federal-sponsored exchange. And in some cases, that's probably what we'll end up doing.
We haven't heard much about the Medicaid expansion in Alaska. Can you explain that part of the law and what Alaskans could gain from it?
Well, so what's going to happen in Medicaid expansion is that right now the program is somewhat limited, if you will, in terms of the sorts of income levels and asset levels that it covers. And it's primarily for low-income women and children. But the expansion is going to allow a wider range of people who cannot get insurance through their employer or otherwise don't qualify for some other federal program, but that have income levels that are above the current Medicaid levels in Alaska. They're now going to be eligible to get insurance through the Medicaid mechanism.
The Affordable Care Act still hasn't done anything yet to make health care insurance more affordable. Why is this? And do you think we'll see more cost-controlling measures in the years ahead?
I think once there's more people covered, then the hope is that indeed healthcare costs generally are going to lower. The other thing that the Affordable Care Act tried to do is to improve the healthcare delivery system, and that in and of itself is going to reduce healthcare costs. For example, if we can show hospitals how to reduce unnecessary readmissions, you'd be alarmed at how many, I think about a third of Medicare beneficiaries who go to the hospital are readmitted to the hospital later because of some complication that arose during the hospital stay. There are ways to stamp that out altogether, and that's pure savings. As you reduce general health care costs, then also insurance premiums can come down because health care gets less expensive. So there's much we can do by improving the quality of care that will save costs in the health care market and in insurance premiums.
John Hammerland is the regional administrator for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. University of Alaska health insurance premiums are going up. Employee health care paycheck deductions will roughly double as of July 1st. The change amounts to $175 per month for a worker on the mid-range coverage plan, adding a spouse and kids, and the premium will then rise more than $490 per month. It's the latest erosion of what used to be considered a Cadillac plan. UA spokeswoman Kate Ripley says the university is playing catch-up after 2 years of flat employee rates.
Everyone knew that that was kicking the can down the road a little bit, but we had made so many different changes in the deductible rates and the out-of-pocket expenses that we felt that was a prudent thing to do so that we weren't making all these changes that affect employees all in 1 year.
The cost of healthcare services in Alaska continues to rise, but Ripley says the overall cost of UA's health plan has actually gone down this year because more workers have opted for higher deductible economy coverage or dropped out of UA insurance altogether. She says the cost of UA's insurance plan, which covers about 9,000 people, is still projected to be $65 million, and there's a shortfall on the employee contribution side.
83% of the costs are picked up by the university, and 17% are picked up by the employee. And what we had happen in this last year, and this is what we have to factor going forward, the employee share is coming up $3.5 million short.
Ripley says the university tried to offset about $500,000 of the shortfall with a $600 surcharge on smokers, but the proposal was unpopular and dropped. She says an alternate idea being considered would be to ban hiring any new tobacco users.
So over time, your pool of employees wouldn't have the health issues that are associated with tobacco causing expenses to the plan.
Ripley says a consultant's report shows the policy would save $21 million in healthcare costs over 15 years. She says the UA administration is considering the policy and will be vetting it with governance groups and employees. Providence Hospital and Alaska Airlines have already adopted no tobacco hire policies.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. 8 hours after you quit smoking, your blood oxygen level returns to normal. In 3 months, your lung function improves up to 30%. And 10 years after you quit, your risk of dying from lung cancer is about half that of a smoker. But right now, you're one cigarette closer to cancer. Every cigarette makes you sick, so quit smoking today. Information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or AlaskaQuitLine.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
A once endangered population of peregrine falcons that nests along the upper Yukon River appears to have stabilized. North American peregrines were decimated by the pesticide DDT and listed as an endangered species in the early 1970s. A long-running study in the Yukon Charley National Preserve has documented 53 nesting pairs for the last 3 years and a 60 to 70% breeding success rate. Biologist Skip Ambrose, who studied upper Yukon peregrines for decades, says the birds have come a long way.
In 1973, the first year that we did this survey, we found 11 pairs in a stretch of river that's about 166 miles. But what we've seen over the course of our 40-year survey is that when DDT was banned or restricted by the United States in 1972, the population stabilized and started to come back. And through the early 2000, we've just been a gradual increase from 11 pairs all the way up to 53 pairs.
Ambrose says the current population may be what the upper Yukon environment can support. He says that's indicated by peregrines nesting closer together in prime bluff and cliff areas along the river.
Peregrines are kind of like wolves and bears. They're the top-of-the-line predator, and sometimes their biggest enemy is themselves in that they start fighting over limited resources. So it just appears like there's more fighting now. The adults are gone from the nest longer to search for prey. They have to go further away. So those two things just seem to be an indication that things are getting tight, and it looks like the population is kind of starting to level off just due to density-dependent factors.
Ambrose says the recovery of the upper Yukon peregrine is unique in that no captive breeding or reintroduction of the birds was employed to bring them back. He says it's clear that the U.S. DDT ban allowed the birds to recover, and he feels lucky to experience their comeback.
Seeing all these long vacant cliffs that I've studied for 40 years that were empty for so long and now they're back to being used again, it's like just a wonderful feeling. And it's rare because most wildlife stories are not so easy or so simple.
Alaska peregrines, which also include an Arctic species, which nests along the Colville River on the North Slope, winter as far south as Argentina. Ambrose says the Alaska birds are still exposed to DDT to some degree outside the U.S. and also face a new threat from mercury pollution.
That could be from a lot of factors, from coal mining in South America to coal plants in China, coal plants in our country, that mercury is deposited atmospherically, and it is showing up in birds in Alaska.
Ambrose says mercury does not appear to be detrimental to peregrine survival right now, but the prospect of increased coal burning makes the threat real. Ambrose plans to be back in the Yukon Charley Preserve this summer for his 40th year counting and studying upper Yukon peregrine falcons. It's March Madness Alaska style this week as adult teams from around Southeast gather in Juneau for the 66th annual gold medal basketball tournament. The event, organized by the Juneau Lions Club, has achieved legendary status in many of the small village communities that dot the panhandle. KTOO's Casey Kelly caught up with players and fans from Angoon as they made their way to the tournament on Saturday.
For many teams, a trip to gold medal starts here, aboard the state ferry Leconte, or one of the other boats that make up the Alaska Marine Highway's Southeast Fleet.
The Blue Canoe, it is very important we have the Blue Canoe.
36-year-old William J. Booth III plays on Angoon's C team for players between the ages of 32 and 42. He grew up in Metlakatla in what he calls a ball family.
My whole family, all my brothers are all ball players. High school ball. A couple of them went to college for a little while, but eventually they moved home and did some fishing. They do still participate in a lot of tournaments, and the biggest one for them is gold medal.
Booth says Angoon's C team has been practicing since last year's tournament, putting in extra work since January. The team is extra motivated this year after playing just three games before getting knocked out of the 2011 gold medal. In a tournament where positions aren't exactly defined for most players, Booth is looking to contribute with defense and hustle.
I like the defense. I like the rebound. I like to get inside and bump elbows. That's where I like to be at.
Angoon's B squad for players under age 32 is coming off two consecutive gold medal championships in their bracket. 21-year-old John Crossman says the B team just hopes to avoid a letdown.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to lose. I want to win.
Crossman says the gold medal tournament is all about bragging rights in Southeast Alaska.
Growing up in Angoon, we played against Huna, Cake, Yakutat, and all those villages, you know, they all come together. And I know a lot of the guys, and I'm pretty cool with most of them. And you just get to see them again, say hi, and play against them. It's like reliving high school.
For Booth, it goes beyond bragging rights when he plays against his brothers on Metlakatla's team. He says they always try to recruit him to play for their squad, but he switched allegiances when he moved to Angoon 6 years ago.
I got to represent my community that I live in, and I want my kids to see me running around with the Angoon jersey, you know. But they know Metlakatla's right there.
Booth's wife, Rihanna Kukesh Booth, is the daughter of State Senator Albert Kukesh, a gold medal Hall of Famer. She says the annual pilgrimage to the tournament sparks a lot of memories.
It's been a big part of my family's life for as long as I can remember. You know, my dad played for many, many years, and as a child, you know, and growing up all through high school, every year we always went to gold medal.
Kukesh Booth says the atmosphere is the same no matter which teams are playing.
There's a lot of village chanting, like, you know, you hear a lot of Huna and a lot of Angoon and Haines, and, you know, they're just pretty much rooting for their village.
The tournament lasts through Saturday at the Juno Douglas High School gym. Besides the B and C brackets, there's also a master's bracket for older players. This year's gold medal is dedicated to the Reverend Dr. Walter Soboloff, who never missed a tournament before passing away last year at the age of 102. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Casey Kelly in Juneau. APRN's Dave Donaldson also reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com. Timing is everything. A mother who waits until her child is at least 2 years old before becoming pregnant again has a better chance of regaining strength and energy between pregnancies. Her baby is more likely to be born on time and at a good weight. So talk to your healthcare provider to find out how to plan your pregnancies and ask for the state's free birth spacing booklet. Take the time to build a strong and healthy family. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Alaska Housing Finance Corporation offers competitive interest rates with programs tailored for first-time homebuyers and home choice seminars that cover the details of purchasing and financing a home. There's more information at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.